This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Thanks for being with us. And on this Monday, the last day of 2018, we begin in El Paso, Texas, the city at the center of the humanitarian crisis at the southern border. A city just shy of 700,000 people that sits along the Rio Grande, El Paso has four customs and border protection ports of entry. Across the river, there's sprawling Ciudad Juarez in Mexico. El Paso is under scrutiny after two migrant children, 7-year-old Jacqueline Kaal Makin and 8-year-old Felipe Alonso Gomez, died while in CBP custody. Jacqueline died in a hospital in El Paso, while Felipe was originally detained at a Border Patrol post near the city. Border Patrol later moved him to New Mexico, where he died. And it has also become a city where federal officials have released thousands of migrants who have successfully completed the first step in applying for asylum. Some have been let out at bus stations without coats or money, leaving aid organizations scrambling to find them food and shelter. In fact, more than 24,000 migrants have been released into El Paso since October. That's five times the number released in the same period last year. And El Paso Mayor Dee Margo told Fox News on Friday that there needs to be action in Washington.
Our immigration policy stinks. No one in Washington on either side of the aisle has had the fortitude to deal with it historically. And it's about time somebody steps up and develops a little manhood on the way and determines what they need to do, irrespective of the political fallout.
A little manhood, huh? As the director of the advocacy group Hope Border Institute in El Paso, our next guest, Dylan Corbett, finds himself dealing directly with the consequences of a failed system. The organization has been coordinating with other groups to find shelter and food for the migrants released by immigration officials. Welcome, Dylan.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm also joined by Bob Moore. Bob is a freelance reporter covering the border for The Washington Post and Texas Monthly, and he's based in El Paso. Bob, thanks for joining us again on the show.
Thanks so much. I appreciate being here.
So, Bob, let's start with you. El Paso has been taking in migrants for years. Can you tell us a little bit about this recent spike?
This really began a couple of months ago, starting in October and then kind of growing from there, where we've had several hundred Central American migrant families each week entering through El Paso, for the most part surrendering to Border Patrol agents, then being detained by the Border Patrol, then processed through ICE, and then released into the community through a non-governmental organization called Annunciation House, where they're housed and fed for a couple of days before they move on to their families elsewhere in the United States. In recent weeks, the pace of release has really increased dramatically. We went from about perhaps 700 people a week in late summer to close to 2,500 people this past week.
Bob, I'm just wondering, you know, we're hearing at least the rhetoric from the administration is that they have made it more difficult for migrants to come into the United States precisely because they want to deter them from doing so. I am a little bit confused about why, since October, 24,000 migrants have since been released into El Paso. Can you explain what's happening here?
Because migrant families are crossing in record numbers. It's important to remember, though, that the total number of unauthorized crossings at the southern border is still far, far below peak levels of the 1990s and early 2000s. But what we are seeing now are these families from Central America fleeing violence and poverty and coming to seek asylum in the United States. It's still possible to cross the border. It's a difficult journey for many. The policies that have been adopted, not just by this administration, but by past administrations, have forced many of them to make far more difficult journeys into very remote areas of the border. In our area, they're crossing most heavily in southern New Mexico to the west of El Paso, where they're going through a very dangerous journey through the desert, which creates a lot of peril for them. But because of the situation they're leaving, it's worth the risk to so many of these families to make that dangerous journey.
Bob, what does being released signify for these families? Does it mean that they've since gone through the process, they've been cleared, and now they can live in the United States?
They've passed the initial stage in a very difficult asylum process, and that's called a credible fear interview, where they're able to demonstrate to an asylum officer that they have credible fear of persecution if they're returned to their home country. When they're released, they're allowed to travel in the United States. They tend to go join family that's already here. It's important to note that once they are released, they are here legally in the United States, no matter the rhetoric you might hear. Because of the backlog in immigration courts right now, the asylum process will probably take, for most of these people, 2 to 3 years to play out.
Dylan, I want to bring you in here. Let's talk a little bit about, if you could, about what aid organizations are doing when you are informed of a group of migrants who have been released. What happens next?
Sure. So El Paso has long been providing assistance to migrants who are passing through our community, to migrants who have been released by the authorities, like these asylum-seeking families that we've seen released into the El Paso community lately. These families are in need of everything from a hot meal to logistical support so that they can call family members and contacts around the country so that they can plan the next leg of their journey. They need a change of clothes. Many of them who have been in the CBP holding cells haven't been able to have a shower or change their clothes in several days. They need hot food. They need nutrition. Some of them do need medical care and medicine. So those are the type of services that the community is stepping up and offering to these people.
Bob, on December 10th, after Jacqueline's death, but before DHS had publicly disclosed it, the CBP commissioner, Kevin McAleenan, had asked for help from Congress. Let's take a listen.
We're designed to process single adults. You'll see diapers and baby formula and children's food. Right now at Paso del Norte in El Paso Port of Entry, you will see kids in the officer break room watching a movie and being cared for by officers. This is not a system that was designed for the arrival of kids and families and the numbers we're seeing. We've worked with Congress to request additional support for child medical care, child mental health and welfare for those arriving, even in that short period of time that we're interacting with these children. It's a critical area that we need to continue to improve.
Bob, you know, one of the things we've heard from the administration has also been that these facilities are not prepared to take in children. You cover the border every day. What have officials been telling you about what they need to support this this increasing group of folks?
It's an interesting question because Commissioner McAleenan clearly outlined the problem in those comments to Congress, which interestingly came 3 days after Jacqueline died. But Commissioner McAleenan did not tell the Congressional Committee about her death. As a matter of fact, the administration tried to keep it a secret, essentially, until my colleague Nick Miroff and I, writing for the Washington Post, found out about it. So you have some rhetoric coming out of the administration, but there's really not any action matching that. Even from the president, all you hear when talking about the needs on the border is wall, wall, wall. CBP has known for 4 years that the face of migration on our southern border is changing. They've made no attempts to make some of the changes that are necessary to provide Border Patrol agents on right on the border the tools and the training they need to take care of this situation. We still have an immigration enforcement system that's built largely around trying to stop single Mexican males from coming into the country seeking work. That's a problem that has not been a significant issue for more than a decade. Rather, now we have these families coming. Despite all of that, we're still shoving families into these tiny holding cells that were meant for single persons to be held for a few hours.
Well, and of course, we've heard from the administration, we've heard both from President Trump and Kirstjen Nielsen. Dylan, President Trump over the weekend tweeted, and I'm quoting here, that any deaths of children or others at the border are strictly the fault of the Democrats, and quote, the two children in question were very sick before they were given over to Border Patrol. I also want to bring your attention to comments that Kirstjen Nielsen made a couple of weeks ago where she was unable to quantify the number of people who had died or who were in custody. What are your thoughts on that, Dylan? I mean, there is a lot of partisanship right now in Washington, but do you think Washington needs to do something despite this to help the situation at the border?
Yeah, my immediate thoughts are that those are highly insensitive comments, if not perverse comments. But they're reflective of something that transcends this administration. What we've been talking about is that precisely because we politicize the border, because of the border politics that transcends just this administration, and because of the policy choices that we've made for many decades here on the border, we're not able to respond to the current reality of the border, which is now we're looking at the large presence of families passing the border. In November, 60% of all border apprehensions were of families. What we have been doing over the last couple decades, and the Trump administration has intensified, is we have been applying a sort of a strategy to militarize the border. And what I mean by that is we focused only on enforcement. We focused only on removal. We focused only on things like deterrence. I remember in 2014 when there was a spike of family arrivals during the Obama administration. The Obama administration explicitly took a quote-unquote posture of a strategy of deterrence to stop this. Unless we make the investments that are needed, unless we change course and respond to the realities on the ground by investing in things like the infrastructure that's needed on the border, in ports of entry to be able to respond to the crossing of families, we're going to see that there are going to be deadly results. We need to take a step back. We need to stop politicizing the border. And we need to make real policy decisions that are going to respond to the realities of the flows of migration.
Dylan Corbett runs the Hope Border Institute, and Bob Moore is a freelance reporter who covers the border. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Over the weekend, Senator Lindsey Graham suggested that the president might be open to a slower approach to pulling U.S. forces out of Syria. That's a sharp departure from the president's initial proposal, in which he declared victory.
We've been fighting for a long time in Syria. I've been president for almost 2 years, and we've really stepped it up. And we have won against ISIS.
Last week, in his surprise visit to Iraq, President Trump tempered that statement and thanked U.S. troops not for a total victory over ISIS, but instead for
the near elimination of the ISIS territorial caliphate in Iraq and in Syria.
The second is true.
That's Rukmini Kalamaki, a terrorism correspondent for The New York Times. She's been covering the group for more than 5 years.
We are at the near elimination of the territorial caliphate, meaning the territory that ISIS once held in Iraq and Syria. That's down to 1% of the land holdings that they once had. But that doesn't in any way suggest that ISIS, the terrorist group, which has recruited members from 100 different countries, is itself defeated.
And there's daily evidence that ISIS is still a threat. In this month alone, the group was connected to a suicide bombing at Libya's foreign ministry, the murder of two women tourists who were hiking in the Atlas Mountains, and an attack at a Christmas market in Strasbourg, just to name a few. So I spoke to Rukmini about the American strategy against ISIS and what we know about the strength and organization of the group as we head into 2019.
What we are seeing is a continuation of what ISIS has been doing for years now, which is a combination of both directed attacks that are carried out by people who travel to the caliphate and by people who simply imbibed the group's rhetoric and propaganda online. The difference is that in Europe and North America, law enforcement is now on the ball, whereas they weren't as much so in 2014 and 2015.
Where does ISIS stand relative to other terrorist organizations that are active in the Middle East and across the African continent?
From where I sit, it remains by far the most deadly. It's the one that still has the greatest appeal. It has the most active social media. Just in Iraq and Syria, the estimates that we have from the Pentagon's Inspector General is that the group still retains between 20,000 and 30,000 fighters. To put that in context, in 2010, which is the last time that the U.S. declared this group defeated, the group was down to around 700 fighters, according to the CIA. So this is more than 20 to 30 times that we are seeing now, and yet our leaders have repeatedly tried to say that the group is defeated.
Now, how much of a threat does ISIS continue to be to the United States specifically?
It seems to me that in North America and also in Europe, that law enforcement has now gotten a grip on what the threat was. I think this is because every time that there's an arrest, they grab the person's phone, they grab the person's electronics, and they work backwards. They go through that person's contacts, and they're able to dismantle the networks that are behind these specific attacks. So I don't foresee that we're going to see major attacks in America or in Europe. Though what is worrying is that the group is still trying. Strasbourg was carried out by a young man who left a Pledge of Allegiance on his USB stick. He had been identified by French law enforcement as being someone who was a Muslim extremist. They had placed him on a list specifically for that. He had also been identified as a security threat. And yet, despite those two identifications, he was still able to go and kill five people in the Strasbourg market.
We also heard that Brett McGurk announced his resignation. Can you tell us what the significance of that was, particularly with this scenario?
Brett McGurk is the top diplomat who was in charge of the fight against ISIS. He's a veteran of three administrations. He began in his role in the Middle East during the Bush administration. During the Obama administration, he became the presidential envoy to the coalition fighting ISIS. And he was considered so valuable in that effort that the Trump administration, possibly not Trump himself, but people around him, kept him on. The fight to get the territorial caliphate back was something that started under Brett McGurk, and it was continued under Brett McGurk. So although he was supposed to retire in February, the fact that he is accelerating his departure is another jab at President Trump. It shows that the highest level officials who are in charge of this fight no longer have confidence in this president.
Does it also signal, though, that our strategy had worked up until now?
I think there's no question that the strategy had worked. I mean, the territorial caliphate is down to 1% of what it used to be. And this was a territory that at its height was the size of Great Britain. I myself was one of the people who was particularly critical of the Obama administration's early attempts to take back the territorial caliphate because it was taking so long. So what the Obama doctrine was basically that American troops should not be doing the fighting themselves. It needs to be local partners on the ground, the Kurds in Syria, Iraqi security forces in Iraq, Libyan military in Libya, etc., who are doing the bulk of the work. And this took a very long time to stand up because many of these armies were in no shape to do the hard work. But what was surprising to me is that when that effort finally got underway, and it really didn't get underway, I would say, until 2016, it worked. And I was with the Iraqi military when they took the city of Mosul, and there was enormous pride amongst those soldiers who had sacrificed greatly to take back that city. They felt like they had done that. So they were empowered by that, and they took ownership of that. So it makes sense that the territory that they hold needs to be erased. And that is still not done. They still have pockets of control in Iraq and Syria. But once that is done, we are back to, you know, where this group was a couple of years ago, where it's an insurgency. And at that point, it becomes much harder to fight it. I think that we're still trying to figure out how to contain what is essentially an idea.
Rukmini, your job title at the Times is terrorism correspondent. How has that job changed over the years in terms of how you monitor groups like ISIS?
The big change that happened in 2013, 2014 is that there was an explosion on social media and specifically on Twitter. That was the first time that I made contact with them. When Twitter finally started to crack down on them, and that took Twitter quite a while, it wasn't until 2015 really that they began making a dent in ISIS's footprint online. The group moved to an app called Telegram. Telegram is an encrypted app that people have on their phone, and it allows you to create a room. They call it a channel, where you can have essentially a private discussion with people who have been given the key to this room. And the key is basically a sentence of gibberish. So that's where it is now. You have to have this sentence of gibberish to be able to enter this room. The only way you can get the sentence of gibberish is from somebody who's already inside the room. And they have populated literally hundreds of rooms, hundreds of channels. They themselves are being suspended every day, and every day they're creating new ones. But this is now the nerve center of where ISIS communicates to its acolytes.
Rukmini Kalamaki is terrorism correspondent for The New York Times. Rukmini, thank you for your reporting.
Thank you, Tansina.
Dear Oscar Grant, my name is Andrew, and I'm from San Jose, California. As I craft this tweet on a southbound BART train that's pulling into West Oakland, there's not a single trip through Fruitvale Station where I don't remember your name.
To Tomorrow, New Year's Day, is the 10th anniversary of Oscar Grant's death. Oscar was 22 years old when he was shot and killed by a police officer while lying on his stomach at the Fruitvale BART commuter rail station in Oakland, California.
Dear Oscar Grant, my name is Anechi, coming from Oakland. And as an African-American male myself, my grandmother used to always be afraid for me to go out on New Year's or 4th of July, holidays like that. And he used to always annoy me. And I remember when your tragic situation happened, it basically reaffirmed everything she was afraid of.
Oscar was unarmed. The officer was eventually convicted of involuntary manslaughter.
You know, every time I go by Fruitvale Station, I call it Grant Station, in your honor.
Leave it up to me. That station would be renamed after you.
Those voices are from a project by KQED in San Francisco, where people are sending messages to Oscar 10 years after his death. Pendarvis Harshaw is leading the effort, and he's a columnist for KQED Arts. And he clearly remembers when he first heard Oscar Grant had been killed.
10 years ago, I'm 21, a junior in college, and at the time, I was headed back to Washington, D.C., and it really juxtaposed everything that was going on in Washington, D.C. with the recent election of President Barack Obama and just the imagery of Oscar Grant being gunned down on a platform at Fruitvale Station in East Oakland by an officer of the law, be it a BART cop. It just stood out as just so far removed from what I was seeing with Barack Obama.
And here we are 10 years later, and we've seen this story happen more times, an unarmed black man killed by police, captured on video. But this was before the Black Lives Matter movement. Can you help us connect the dots between what happened with Oscar Grant? Because I think that was one of the first examples, sadly, that we've seen of the use of cell phone footage in an incident like this.
Yeah, the cell phones played a major part in Oscar Grant's story. The people on the platform who documented the heinous murder of Oscar Grant really played a part in making sure that his story got out there, and so news outlets saw it in their face. Now, this isn't new, but seeing the actual footage made that news arrive on people's digital doorstep, and they couldn't ignore it. And that's what you've seen time and time again over the past 10 years. And so I do think it did start to tip the scale a little bit in terms of seeing how real this problem is.
You've been working with Oscar Grant's family for KQED's coverage of this anniversary, this 10-year anniversary since Oscar's passing. What does the family want people to know about Oscar, about his life, about what happened to him 10 years later?
Working closely with Cephas Johnson, also known as Uncle Bobby, Oscar's close uncle, he really points out a couple of things. One, how artists have carried Oscar Grant's name and story. Two, Uncle Bobby has become an activist, working with families who encounter issues related to police brutality as well. So it's been amazing to see his growth, to go from just a civilian to somebody who stands up and supports families who go through similar instances. And lastly, they have been working with me to get the community to voice their stories. As Uncle Bobby realizes, this story not only impacts his family, it impacts the larger community. So we have this Dear Oscar Grant initiative where we're having people send messages of how Oscar Grant's story impacted their lives. And it's been beautiful to see.
Tell me a little bit about Cephas's activism. How has he, you mentioned a little bit that he'd grown into, this is Oscar's uncle, that he'd grown into being an activist. What does that look like today?
From the outside, you know, I can only speak from the outside, but to see his growth, to go from somebody who was essentially an uncle who was impacted by this to now a community member who stands up for fighting for people impacted by police brutality has just been awesome to see from the outside, and the community that he's developed around him and the support that he's gathered from community members has been beautiful to see as well.
And you mentioned the project you're working on with KQED, and you're asking for community members to write something to Oscar, whether it's a text. Tell us about the project. Where did it begin, and what are you asking for?
10 years ago when I met Uncle Bobby, he would tell the story of the last interaction that he had with his nephew Oscar, and he would say it was a text exchange. And I realized more and more how cell phones played a significant role in Oscar Grant's story, from the video footage to this text exchange. So I thought it would behoove us, KQED, as a platform that serves the community, to allow people to send text messages or to call in and leave voicemails. And so the goal is to take these stories, these messages, and use them to push forward on Uncle Bobby's organization and making sure that police brutality is recognized as an issue in society.
Are there folks that you talk to in the community who, because it's been 10 years, who don't know who Oscar Grant is?
Yes. The changes in demographics in the city of Oakland has definitely made it so, you know, you'll point to Fruitvale Station and you'll say, hey, Oscar Grant was killed there. And people are like, what are you talking about?
How does that make you feel?
It's significant. It shows the changes in just in 10 years, you know, no need for a census count. Like something just as well as knowing the story of a community or not knowing the story of a community. It's a line in the sand. It's a demarcation of like, okay, you can see where things have changed.
Do you feel that ultimately Oscar's memory will be cemented in some way so that he's not forgotten?
Yeah, I think it's pretty interesting. Locally, there's an artist named Reefa One who's painting a mural on Fruitvale Station to commemorate the life of Oscar Grant. The project is actually backed by BART. So that's awesome to see. And then the second layer is that Oscar Grant's family is pushing for Fruitvale Station to be renamed in Oscar Grant's honor. And it is a tall order to ask, but I think it'd be admirable.
Well, we'll be paying close attention to that. Penn, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Pendarvis Harshaw is a columnist for KQED Arts. His memoir about growing up in Oakland is called OG Told Me. And you can send your own message to Oscar Grant by texting or leaving a voicemail at 510-853-9328 or going to our website, thetakeaway.org. In 2018, the Me Too movement raised our awareness of sexual harassment and assault within and outside of the workplace. But awareness alone isn't enough to make systemic change. So we're taking a look at the successes and failures of state laws that took the movement beyond a hashtag. Maya Raghu is the Director of Workplace Equality for the National Women's Law Center. Maya, great to have you with us.
Thanks, Tanzina. It's great to be here.
So I love this idea that we went beyond the hashtag and actually into policy. Let's take a look at the big picture. Over the past year, how much of a nationwide push was there for new laws related to Me Too?
It was much broader than I think most people are aware of. In the last year, states and cities have really stepped up to lead the way in passing reforms to address workplace harassment. States across the country introduced over 100 bills last year, and 11 actually passed legislation addressing common problems and barriers that a lot of victims face in the workplace.
Now, of course, we know that there are many ways to define workplace harassment, but were there some common themes in terms of defining it and what people were looking for in terms of changing these environments?
Yes. And, you know, the National Women's Law Center Fund houses the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund, which is celebrating its one-year anniversary tomorrow. And the thousands of requests from assistance that have come in have sort of reflected some common themes that we've also heard from workers around the country. And one of them is that there's still a lot of fear and secrecy about sexual harassment and sexual assault in the workplace. But it's not an accident, and that's because employers have been using these tools that have ended up silencing victims, making them afraid to come forward, and really hiding the true extent of harassment in a workplace. And so that's part of what a lot of states and cities focused on this past year in terms of policy, and a lot of states actually passed legislation to address that. And one of those things, one of those tools that employers use are non-disclosure agreements, or NDAs.
So let's talk about these NDAs, or non-disclosure agreements. What are they? How have they been used by employers? And how are you trying to change that?
So NDAs are agreements, or they're parts of agreements, that prevent people from talking about certain things or disclosing certain information. People are asked to sign NDAs at the time they are hired for a job. And these NDAs say, you know, they can't talk to their coworkers about harassment or discrimination. They can't come together to challenge it. They can't go to a civil rights agency or law enforcement to report assault or discrimination. People are also being asked to sign NDAs in the context of settlement agreements. So let's say someone actually has come forward to make a complaint. The employer is trying to resolve that and they end up settling. Those settlements frequently contain clauses that say that the employee can't talk to anyone about the facts of their case or where it happened or what happened.
Why are people signing these? I mean, are they becoming more and more popular?
They are becoming more and more common. People are signing them because in many cases, they don't have a choice. You know, particularly for people in low-wage jobs, they may not have the resources to hire an attorney to negotiate an employment contract for them or to negotiate a settlement agreement. So if you really need a job to support your family, maybe you're not reading the employment contract that you're signing, you don't really have a choice. You need that job. So a lot of people accept them without really understanding what they're signing away or the consequences of it.
What are some of the states that have made significant moves here when it comes to improving working conditions and really addressing harassment in the workplace?
So, you know, it's not just California and New York, which is what most people would think. We've actually seen movement on a variety of issues in states across the country. So on the issue of NDAs, you know, places like Arizona, Tennessee, and Vermont, and Washington State passed laws to either ban NDAs in employment contracts or to limit their use in settlements. We saw several states, including Maryland and Washington State, try to address the use of forced arbitration in employment contracts, which means employees have to give up their day in court and have to take employment disputes to a private process that's largely controlled by employers. We saw action in many states, including Delaware, New York State, and Vermont, to extend protections to more workers. You know, what's been interesting in the last year is a lot of people either aren't aware of their rights when it comes to harassment and discrimination, or they think they're protected by the laws when they actually aren't. So, for example, people who work in the gig economy, independent contractors, interns, people who aren't in traditional employment relationships aren't fully protected by our federal civil rights laws. So a lot of states stepped up in the last year to extend that protection, and also to people who work in small workplaces.
And we know the Me Too movement hashtag really took flight this year, but it's something that's been around for at least more than a decade with Tarana Burke at the helm there. One of the questions I have is, you know, because it's been around for so long, because this isn't an issue that's going to go away quickly, what is it that women and or men, or employees, should I say, should do or can do if they feel that they need help?
So one of the things that they can do is to call the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund, where there's a network of attorneys across the country who are volunteering their time, who have agreed to give a free legal consultation to people who've been victims of sexual harassment and retaliation in the workplace, so that people can learn about their rights and about their options. We know that not everyone wants to file a lawsuit. A lot of people
can afford to,
or
right?
Can't.
I mean,
or
there's
afford
fear,
to.
Maya, isn't there?
Yes.
Like, isn't there fear of retaliation, as you said, or fear of not being able to afford a lawyer, afford to take out a lawsuit? And I think most people would say they're fearful for their future job prospects.
Absolutely. And that's actually one of the biggest barriers that we're seeing, is that people are afraid, with good reason, of coming forward to talk about sexual harassment and assault, because it's a huge risk to their personal safety, to their jobs and their careers if they do so. You know, you mentioned retaliation, which is when employers take negative actions against people who do complain. you know, people gain a reputation as a, quote, troublemaker.
Difficult.
They're blackballed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're blackballed from other jobs in their industry. So it drives a lot of people out of their jobs, out of their careers. It has these long-term economic impacts that, you know, we should be talking more about. Retaliation is against the law, right? But the problem is that the law isn't being enforced enough. So there's still a lot of fear of coming forward. And then a lot of people who do want to find out about their rights, and a lot of people have been empowered to do that in the last year because of Me Too, oftentimes are coming forward for the first time in 5, 10, 20 years to talk about this and to see what they can do and find out that they've run out of time to do anything about it and their legal options, because the time frame for filing a claim with a civil rights agency is really short. It's between, you know, 6 months to a year.
Really? And it That's takes, short. Okay.
Yeah. And it takes time. You know, for a lot of people, they're working through trauma. They're trying to decide if they want to take any steps because they're afraid of retaliation. And then they find out, you know, you're timed out. You have very few legal options, which is incredibly disappointing. So we're also seeing states trying to address that by increasing the length of time to file a claim so people at least have that option. And that's something that we're going to see more of in the next year.
Maya Raghu is the Director of Workplace Equality for the National Women's Law Center. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.